It is Friday, January the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the U.S. Vice President showing support for the people of Iran.
To see the people of Iran rising up to demand change in their country should hearten every freedom-loving American and people who cherish freedom around the world.
U.S. suspending security assistance to Pakistan, rescinding Obama-era policy to interfere with marijuana-friendly states, plus the sounds of Sweet Baby James. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States promising support for protesters in Iran, condemning Iranian officials for a crackdown that has left more than 20 people dead and more than 1,000 others under arrest. Iran has accused the U.S. of meddling in its internal affairs. Iran's U.N. ambassador says Washington has, in his words, stepped up the acts of intervention in a grotesque way under the pretext of support of sporadic protests, which he said have been hijacked by infiltrators. President Trump, in a tweet, praised the Iranian people for finally acting against the brutal and corrupt Iranian regime. Vice President Pence, in a VOA interview, said that U.S. support for the Iranian people is more than just verbal, saying that existing sanctions are working and called for a better nuclear deal with Tehran.
They're not just working in Iran. We believe they're working in North Korea. This president, this administration, are absolutely committed to continue to bring the full economic weight of the United States and these economic sanctions to bear on Iran. We're also working with the Congress to arrive at a new agreement, a new set of conditions for sanctions going forward. The reality is the Iran nuclear deal was so ill-founded because in part, not only did it not deny that Iran could develop a nuclear weapon, by only being a 10-year agreement, it virtually guaranteed that they would develop a nuclear weapon after that 10-year period of time. What we want is to have a long-term agreement in place, long-term legislation in place that it says if at any time Iran attempts to obtain a usable nuclear weapon and the ballistic missiles to be able to deliver it, that all sanctions would be reimposed immediately.
Vice President Pence said the sanctions that are already in place are having an effect on the nation, the economy as well, and have emboldened the people of Iran. James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former diplomat, tells my colleague Victor Beatty the final decision on how the government will deal with the protest rests ultimately with the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
President Rouhani has spoken out, but more significantly, the supreme leader, Khamenei, has also spoken out, but they took different tacks. Khamenei said that this was all the fault of foreign agents, mainly the United States and, of course, Saudi Arabia, whereas Rouhani tried to take a gentler and kinder approach on the right to protest. But at the end of the day, it will be the supreme leader and the armed fist of the revolution, which is the Revolutionary Guards, that will be called upon to deal with this. Now, they've got a very diffuse, broad problem that is deeply entrenched in the population. That's what we've seen. This is not likely to overthrow the regime, but it's going to create very significant problems.
There are some that view this as a short-term event, that it will die down. Do you think there's the possibility that these could be prolonged protests?
I think that depending upon how smart or stupid the government is and how lucky they are, these could go on a while or they could eventually fade away. But the underlying sentiment is broadly shared in the population. They have not participated in the economic growth of the country. They see their country involved in all of these foreign adventures in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, Afghanistan, you name it. And they don't see any benefit to them of that. And there's clearly a major disappointment with the Rouhani leadership. He won in an almost landslide a little over a year ago.
President Trump has been rather vocal in his support of the demonstrators. Is that wise, given the relative amount of anti-U.S. sentiment there is in Iran?
So far, so good. If I had to pick the best moment in the Trump presidency for foreign policy, it would be this, including the president himself. First of all, he has avoided what President Obama did, which was to simply ignore it. He has called out the government for using oppression, using violence against the protesters, broadly supported the protesters. But what he hasn't done, is to put American support behind them or in any way indicate that we're going to intervene in any way to try to overthrow the regime. So by the standards of 2009, when President Obama said nothing, I think he gets good marks.
Reuters is quoting a senior Trump administration official as saying the U.S. is trying to collect actionable information that could allow it to pursue sanctions against Iranian individuals and organizations that are involved in the crackdown.
That is absolutely my belief. You can cite me on that as well.
In his tweet, President Trump told the Iranian people, and I quote, "You will see great support from the United States at the appropriate time." He did not elaborate. Also in the news, the United States suspending security assistance to Pakistan. U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert makes the announcement.
Until the Pakistani government takes decisive action against groups, including the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network, we consider them to be destabilizing the region and also targeting U.S. personnel, the United States will suspend that kind of security assistance to Pakistan.
Nor gave no details on exactly what aid would be affected and how much. Speculation over what the U.S. may do has created a lot of uncertainty and anxiety in Pakistan following President Trump's New Year's Day tweet. He threatened to slash funding to Pakistan, accusing the country of giving safe haven to terrorists and playing U.S. leaders, in his words, for fools.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Just days after recreational marijuana became legal in the U.S. state of California, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions is announcing he will rescind Obama-era policies of not interfering with marijuana-friendly states. VOA's Lori London asked Los Angeles, California Attorney Aaron LaChant what this will mean for states that have legalized marijuana.
What happens now is that a lot of folks are looking to see if there's going to be a change of enforcement patterns. Under the Cole Memorandum and other previously issued memorandums under the Obama administration, there were set priorities for U.S. attorneys to consider when bringing cases relating to cannabis activity. And now, with the repeal of those memorandums, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is leaving it solely to the discretion of his U.S. attorneys and the acting U.S. attorneys. And so everyone is looking at each U.S. attorney's office, wondering what is my U.S. attorney's policy going to be? Is it going to differ from the Cole Memorandum in the Obama administration? Does he or she have different priorities?
How much of a concern should this be for states that have legalized marijuana, whether it be for medical purposes or for recreational?
I think it should be a concern for everybody because this entire industry is premised upon violations of federal law. And the federal government, whether they bring charges or not, just got a lot more authority. They have a broader reach to go against, to file cases against providers whom they believe are in violation of the federal law. So I think that everyone should be concerned about the risk of the federal government filing charges in connection with cannabis activity.
How would this potentially impact some of these states financially, given that they've already invested so much?
I think it affects the states financially from the tax programs, if there is a crackdown on the businesses, I think consumers are going to be less likely to shop at the stores, knowing that they might be the locations of federal enforcement. And DEA agents or DOJ officials might come in kicking the doors down with high-powered firearms pointed at people. I think that might scare people away from going to dispensaries if those images start appearing in the media again. And if there's fewer customers going to the dispensaries, then that's less tax revenue for the cities and states, and this gets driven back to an unregulated underground economy. The storefront dispensaries have really come a long way over the last 10 years from an appearance standpoint to look much more like every other business than how they used to look 10 years ago, where there was a seeming shadiness or underground element to it. These businesses have come a long way, and federal enforcement is likely to push them back underground and impact the consumers, because it's just a more intimidating experience when it's an underground activity.
It's interesting, because we had the president, when he was campaigning, talk about how he wasn't going to, this was a state issue, and that he was going to leave it alone. And now we know this is a big issue for Attorney General Jeff Sessions, but it seems costly, it seems expensive, and it seems like, I don't know, would it be difficult to actually prosecute?
Given the broad federal prohibition and the openness in which these businesses conduct their activity, they're actually very easy cases to prosecute. Listen, if the Department of Justice wants to take a smart approach like the Obama administration when there was enforcement against cannabis activity, a letter from the federal government goes a long way in shuttering operations. Lots of times, as soon as a business receives a letter from the federal government, which costs nothing for the federal government to send, a landlord will immediately kick the business out. These landlords aren't activists. They aren't willing to go to prison or lose their buildings over their commercial cannabis tenant. But if the federal government, you know, want to do these big flashy raids, not only are they politically unpopular and scary to the majority of the population, they're also expensive. And it's a lot of money and a lot of manpower to shut down one illegal marijuana business when they could get the exact same result by sending a letter to the landlord.
That's Aaron LaShawn. He is a Los Angeles-based attorney, and he was speaking with VOA's Lori London.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
There's a lot of talk here in Washington, and around the world for that matter, about a new book titled Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House. It's by author Michael Wolff, who says he obtained the content of the book by speaking with many Trump administration officials during the past 18 months, including former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon. Many say that the book depicts the Trump administration in an unflattering way and tells the story that Mr. Trump did not expect to win the 2016 presidential election. For some perspective on all of this, my colleague Sarah Williams speaks with VOA White House correspondent Peter Heinlein.
Why are we surprised that there's a portrait of the Trump White House that's not flattering? Almost every portrait that's been written has been not flattering. And furthermore, why in the world do you think they would want to have Michael Wolff, a more or less Hollywood tabloid-type reporter, given free access to the White House to talk to all kinds of people about Donald Trump and his inner circle of people? You've got to expect, and they must have known, that this was going to happen. Now, what about the allegation that, you know, he may have not wanted to win, that Donald Trump might not have really have wanted to win? I think he was as surprised as anybody. The polls, just hours before the polls closed, the opinion polls were showing maybe a 70% chance that Hillary Clinton would win. He was as surprised as the next guy. We were right here in this room, in this studio that night, and I remember we were all just stunned, and I'm sure Donald Trump must have been the same.
Mm. Well, there has been there's quite a bit of criticism of President Trump by Steve Bannon, who was once the White House chief strategist. And Bannon criticizes Donald Trump Jr., saying that a meeting he had with the Russians was, he calls it, treasonous and unpatriotic. He also is critical of Ivanka Trump, President Trump's daughter, saying she sort of is having her eye on a future run of her own for the White House. And Trump has not been too pleased by this.
No, Trump has not been too pleased by this. But if you notice, most of the criticism was of Trump's family and his inner circle, the Ivankas, the Kushners, the others. The book really didn't go after Trump himself that much. Now, on the other hand, Trump was furious, in the words of his spokeswoman Sarah Sanders, who called this trashy tabloid fiction, and confirmed that the president was really angry. But by the way, the president just a few moments ago called reporters in. It was unscheduled. He had a closed press event, but he called the press in at the last minute just so he could take a question about this book, and his answer was, and this is what he wanted to say. He said, "Hey, Bannon called me a great man last night. He changed his tune pretty quick." And then he said, "Oh, I don't talk to him." And Bannon was rather complimentary of the president last night in comments, I think, on Sirius Radio, on Breitbart Radio. There's a lot of peculiar things going on here. The relationship between Bannon and Trump has always been a very peculiar one.
Yes, because at one point they were close allies, seemingly, when Bannon was working at the White House.
Yes, he was a strategist, and for a time was a very important strategist. And after he left the White House, pushed out presumably by the Ivanka Trumps and the Jared Kushners, when John Kelly was appointed as chief of staff, he kept saying, "I'm going to work for Trump's agenda." And he has said that repeatedly, including last night, that he's a believer in Trump's agenda. But he and Trump and some of the establishment Republicans, and by the way, this helps Trump by painting him as more of an establishment Republican. Bannon is against them, and this is probably going to play very nicely into their 2018 midterm election campaign, because this is going to paint Trump supporting candidates as the moderates in the party.
Well, also, President Trump said that Bannon, I believe he said this yesterday, that Bannon has nothing to do with my presidency. And he also made the famous quote saying Bannon has lost his mind. I can't really think of recently of a president sort of questioning someone's mental stability, particularly somebody who had worked for them.
No, but I think if you've been watching cable news lately, you see a lot of pundits questioning President Trump's mental stability. So this gives him the opportunity to throw the shoe on the other foot. It reminds me in a way of World Wrestling Federation, the fake guys who are throwing people on the mat and people are cheering, "Oh yeah, let's go get them." But it's all phony. It's all made up. And don't forget, the head of World Wrestling Federation, Linda McMahon, is a member of Trump's cabinet.
True. All right. Well, thanks very much. That's White House correspondent Peter Heinlein.
And that is VOA's Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chile have found a new heart failure treatment that uses umbilical cord-derived stem cells may lead to remarkable improvements in heart muscle function and quality of life for those suffering from this condition. The American Heart Association says heart failure means that your heart isn't pumping blood as it should and is unable to keep up with the body's need for blood and oxygen. Heart failure is usually treated with medication and changes in lifestyle. The researchers found that a year after heart failure patients were given this new treatment, they showed a significant and continued improvement in their heart's ability to pump blood and had an improved quality of life. They also found the treatment was safe with no adverse effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now a little something from the world of music.
Take to the highway, won't you lend me your name? Your way and my way seem to be one and the same. Mama don't understand it, she wants to know where I've been. I'd have to be some kind of natural born fool to wanna pass that way again. But you know I could feel it on a country road.
James Taylor is an American singer, songwriter, and guitarist, a five-time Grammy Award winner who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. He's one of the best-selling musical artists of all time, having sold more than 100 million records worldwide, including the album which featured Country Roads.
I don't know nothing about the wild wind, but I can tell you that it's bound to be, because I could feel it, child, yeah, on a country road. Guess my feet know where they want me to go, walking on a country road, yeah.
Born in the U.S. state of Massachusetts in 1948, Taylor learned to play the cello as a child in the state of North Carolina, where his family moved in 1951. A few years later, he switched to the guitar, and with tons of hits throughout his five decades career, James Taylor has some personal favorites, including Something in the Way She Moves.
There's something in the way she moves, or looks my way, or calls my name, that seems to leave this troubled world behind. If I'm feeling down blue, or troubled by some foolish game, she always seems to make me change my mind. I feel fine anytime she's around me now. She's around me now almost all the time. And if I'm well, you can tell that she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long, long time, and I feel fine.
Taylor married singer-songwriter Carly Simon in 1972. She likely influenced many of his early songs. They divorced in 1983. He married twice more and currently lives with wife Caroline in Washington, Massachusetts, with their twin sons. Taylor has two other children from previous marriages, Sally and Ben, both musicians.
Yes, and to silently remind me of the happiness and good times that I know. Well, I said I just got to know them. It isn't what she's got to say, or how she thinks or where she's been. To me, the words are nice, the way they sound. I'd like to hear them best that way. It doesn't much matter what they mean. But she says they're mostly just to calm me down. And I feel fine anytime she's around me now. But she's around me.
At 69 years old, James Taylor is often out on the road singing to sold-out concerts. His 1970 hit, Fire and Rain, is always on the playlist.
Just yesterday morning,
They let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that...
Funny thing, he was very popular when I was young. My oldest son, who's now 37 almost, went to a concert with his mom to see James Taylor. The next week, he took on Megadeth as his favorite band. Quite a bit of difference. Anyway, thanks everyone for joining us today on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned, and then we hope that you'll have a super Friday. Now some more from James Taylor.
Next, an Maybe international public service announcement by the United States government.
Countering Hezbollah is a top priority for the United States. That's why the U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Nathan Sales, announced rewards for two senior Hezbollah leaders under the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. The United States is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Talal Hamia. Hamia has been linked to several terrorist attacks, hijackings, and kidnappings targeting U.S. citizens. Hamia leads Hezbollah's International Terrorist Unit, the so-called External Security Organization, which is responsible for planning and conducting terrorist attacks outside of Lebanon. These attacks have targeted primarily Americans and Israelis. The U.S. is also offering a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Fuad Shukr. Shukr is a senior military commander of Hezbollah's forces in Lebanon. He's also a member of the Jihad Council, Hezbollah's highest military body. Shukr plays a key role in Hezbollah's military operations in Syria, and he helped plan and launch the 1983 attack on the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Beirut that killed 241 Marines. These are the first Hezbollah-related rewards under the Rewards for Justice program in a decade. This announcement is just one part of the effort to counter Hezbollah's terrorist activities, said Ambassador Sales. Until Hezbollah stops using terrorism and violence to achieve its goals, the United States and our allies will aggressively target its terrorism infrastructure and financial support networks. If you have any information about Talal Hamia or Fuad Shukr, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call 1-800-877-3927. Absolute confidentiality is assured, and relocation may be available.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
From Washington, then.